Greetings, welcome to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you on this Sunday, May 15th, 2005.
It's 1 p.m. Media.
I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and today we're going to be talking with the publisher of arguably the leading journal of opinion on the American left and American progressive politics over the past 140 years. We'll be talking with Victor Novasky, publisher of The Nation magazine, today on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
From the 2005 National Conference for Media Reform in St. Louis, Missouri, this is Media Minutes, your review of news at the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
The window is open. This is our chance. I don't know how long it's going to be open. I don't know how long this chance is going to be there, but it's now. The next year, 2, 5 years, 10 years, this is it. We have a great opportunity to really participate in constructively and even radically transforming this country for the better, and at the very least, stopping it from going further down a hellhole.
That's University of Illinois professor and Free Press co-founder Robert McChesney kicking off the inaugural meeting of the Academic Brain Trust in St. Louis Thursday. More than 120 scholars spent 3 hours in a brainstorming session about how to merge academic research with activist projects dedicated to issues of media reform.
There is an emerging media reform and media activist movement in this country that's grown rapidly in the last 2 or 3 years. And by the glacial speed of academia, it won't show up in the Journal of Communication until like 2011. So I don't want you to have to wait till it hits one of our journals before you know about it.
The time factor is more important than at first blush. Ben Scott, policy director of Free Press and a doctoral student at the University of Illinois Institute of Communications Research, says pseudo-research dominates media policy discussions in Washington, D.C. because research for hire is willing to work on tight deadlines. He says real academics need to pay closer attention to the time element.
We are inundated constantly in the public interest community with reports and studies by coin-operated think tanks that are quite happy to produce a study by next Tuesday. And who cares if the data doesn't match? And who cares if the argument doesn't make any sense? Because the only thing going to read on Capitol Hill is the executive summary anyway. And if you got a fancy logo at the top and it looks like a report and it acts like a report, it's going in the record.
Other D.C. veterans were on hand to pass along some practical knowledge to scholars who may be new to policy debates. Mark Cooper, director of research for the Consumer Federation of America, has been doing research in D.C. for public interest groups for a quarter century. He told the academics assembled to check their objectivity at the door.
Practicing political economy as a social scientist, you are an activist. I am an activist. This is an adversarial process. It is not an academic debate. The judge and the jury are someplace else, maybe in Congress, maybe in the courts.
Cooper also emphasized the time element. Research that strikes on Capitol Hill while an issue has the briefest attention of Congress can be incredibly empowering.
Identify the politically relevant issues early. They may not be academically interesting, but the politically relevant issues are what matter.
After the background briefing, the scholars split into 11 groups and brainstormed for about an hour on topics ranging from media consolidation to internet governance to public broadcasting. Each group was encouraged to come to consensus on common research projects and continue the collaboration once the conference is over. Marjorie Hines, director of the Freedom of Expression Project at New York University, says one of the most important steps scholars should take immediately is in the realm of information sharing.
Scholars who are working in the area of communications research often have to buy rather expensive privately maintained databases. And could there be a way that the combined bargaining power of scholars could be used to increase access and usability of these databases at lowered cost?
To that end, the Academic Brain Trust plans to establish its own database of shared research interests in the hope of pursuing more collaborative projects and linking media reform activists to the academic world. Most of the formative work is expected to begin in September. And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. Newspaper circulation has been falling gradually for the last several years, but it turns out that the decline would be even worse if newspapers weren't padding their figures. An audit of several major newspapers found that many deliberately inflate their circulation figures by distributing leftovers to places like schools and hospitals, even making unsolicited free home deliveries. The problem is that the circulation figures are generally interpreted as being indicative of the number of paid subscribers, and these practices skew that assumption. It's estimated that circulation padding hikes the weekly average national newspaper audience by well more than a million. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, our guest is Victor Navasky, the renowned editor, writer, and teacher, who is now the publisher of The Nation magazine, served as editor for 17 years, from 1978 to 1995, and also is a professor in the Columbia School of Journalism in New York City. Victor Navasky is the author of several books, including the award-winning Naming Names, and is the author of a brand new book just released, A Matter of Opinion, which I've had the privilege of reading. Welcome to Media Matters, Victor Navasky.
It's good to be here, Bob.
Well, Victor, this book, for starters, is not the sort of book I normally have on the air in one sense. Normally I get books that are sort of academic-y, or they're written with sort of a political argument. And, you know, once you've been a professor long enough, you learn how to read those books quickly. And you learn, you know what I mean. You look at the first couple paragraphs, you sense what the argument is, you sort of see where the evidence comes in, and then you see what the conclusions are. And I can nail one of these books, even if it's 400 pages, in a couple hours, I can get a pretty good read of it and know whether I need to go back into it. And I got your book handed to me last night. I said, okay, this is great. I'm going to give it one of my grad student specials. And it's got so much rich information and about your life and about the milieu of publishing and journalism and politics in the United States in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s that it's impossible to do that. You just get sucked in. You cannot sort of whiz through this book. It's a real page-turner. It's a pleasure to read, and so it's a pleasure to have you on the air with us.
Well, that's kind of you to say. I had one great advantage, Bob. I never took a course in writing per se, but when I got out of the Army, I went in the Army at the end of the Korean War, I got the GI Bill and I went to the Yale Law School, and they had a professor there named Fred Rodell who taught a course on writing about the law. And Fred believed that he wrote a famous article some years before, which he published in the University of Virginia Law Review, called Farewell to Law Reviews. And the first sentence was, there's two things wrong with all legal writing. One, its content, and two, its style. And the course he taught, he would have us write about complicated cases, but you weren't allowed to use legalism. So you weren't allowed to use the phrase like due process. You had to explain what it meant. And also, he took the oath never to write another footnote. So I worked for him when I was in law school, and I inherited some of that, I guess.
Well, let's talk a little bit, before we go into your own history, which is a really interesting part of the book, let's go through, the topic of the book, A Matter of Opinion, The Nation, and really journals of opinion, because you have a very important argument here based on your experience on the role journals of opinion play, the problems they face in our society, and why we should all care about journals of opinion. What do you mean by journals of opinion? And, what is their characteristics compared to other types of media, and why should we care about them?
A lot of questions.
Well, we've got a lot of time
about that, Robert.
I know you should. It's 400 pages long.
Okay. So, first of all, literally, the journals of opinion that are around today in the United States, I would point to The Nation, The New Republic, National Review, The Weekly Standard. What they have in common is that they are views magazine, V-I-E-W-S, rather than news magazines. They do their best, at their best, to explain the underlying meaning of the news, number one. Number two, they are very open about their politics. And they all cover politics and culture, but they have politics at their center. And they, you know, I worked at the New York Times Magazine for a while, and the New York Times Magazine denied that it had any ideology. And it is a different kind of magazine than these magazines because it purports to report the objective facts. But if you don't believe that there's any such thing as objectivity in the way they think about it, and if you believe, as I do, that the difference between, the say, The Nation and National Review and the New York Times, in terms of ideology, is that The Nation has the ideology of the liberal left and National Review has the ideology of the conservative right, I would say the New York Times Magazine and the mainstream media writ large has the ideology of the center, and it is part of the ideology of the center to deny that it has an ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's because they're unaware of it or it's a strategy for talking, I've never been able to quite know or understand. And I have an exercise at The Nation that sometimes I do with Nation interns, which is that in order to discover what the ideology of the center is, I ask them to copy out, you know, the Times on page two has they have corrections where they correct a date or the spelling or something, but they also every few months will run something called editor's note. And they'll say something like, it's wrong for the Times to have said Mort Zuckerman, the owner of U.S. News and World Report, has a notoriously short temper because it is against Times policy to print anonymous pejoratives. Or it's wrong for the Times to say that so-and-so did such-and-such because it is wrong for... It is against Times policy for the Times to print accusations without giving the accused the chance to respond. And they copy these out, and we got something like 26 of these rules that they enunciate. And then I say, okay, now let's see if they're evenly applied. And I'm going to give you, I'm talking now to Nation interns, some hypotheses, but I want you to come up with some of your own. I'm going to say they don't apply to children. I'm going to say they don't apply to prisoners. I'm going to say they don't apply to foreigners. I'm going to say they don't apply to communists. I'm going to say, that do they or don't they apply to poor people of color? And in that way, and then you go and you look at the paper and you see whether these rules are applied evenly across the board. And if they're not, that helps you to find out where the ideology of the center is. Now, a magazine like The Nation and journals of opinion on the left are very, start out being very suspicious of the official line, very skeptical about it, and take very seriously the late I.F. Stone's reminder that all governments are liars.
We're talking to Victor Novasky today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Victor Novasky is the publisher of The Nation magazine, author of the brand new book, A Matter of Opinion, just published, I think, this month, if I'm not mistaken, Victor.
May 11th,
so 4 days before going on air. And I want to alert our listeners that this show program was recorded earlier in the week. This is not a live show, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, and let the professional yakkers do the yakking today. Can a publication like The Nation ever be a mass readership publication? Could it ever have a circulation like People magazine or Time magazine even?
I don't think so. You know, Carrie McWilliams, who was the editor of The Nation from the early 1950s to the mid-1970s and had written for it before that, used to say, and the country was smaller at the time, that there were 250,000 people who, if we were smart enough and good enough and entrepreneurial enough, who ought to pay to read The Nation. And among that 250,000 would be some who wanted who wouldn't necessarily agree with it, but felt they had to read it. And these are people who are interested in the life of the mind, and it's not a mass magazine. It is really aimed at what used to be called the influential segment of the population. Now, I can't say, though, where the number stops. from that, because I'm not talking about people with formal education. We have people who have dropped out of school very early who read this magazine, and it means a great deal to them. One of our contributors, a writer named Earl Shores, once said something to me that stuck with me. He said, you know, then you should publish The Nation on behalf of the people who don't read it, on behalf of people who are not, you know, didn't have the educational upbringing, don't have the resources to buy it, and, it should be published on behalf of the dispossessed and the disenfranchised. And the trick is to do that without condescension, because you really want to engage your readers. But there are ways of falsely inflating magazine subscriptions that we don't play that game. So we now have the highest number of subscribers we've ever had in the history of the magazine. It's at the last time we audited it, it was at 184,000, something like 276. And when I got there in 1978, Ham Fish and I, we had about 20,000 paying subscribers. So
that's really extraordinary. Now, can you make George W. Bush your honorary circulation drive manager, do you think? How much of that is due to the Bush administration?
Well, I think it's, we've had a bad joke for many years. If it's bad for the country, it's good for the nation. So people say, how are you doing? I say, better than ever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that I think it is important, but I think it's dialectical. It's not automatic. There are a lot of people who disagree with George Bush who have not, who are in the publishing business, who have not had the same response. And it's writers, like yourself, and we can persuade you to do it, but like Jonathan Schell and others, Katha Pollitt, who it's the interplay, the conversation, the argument, the debate that goes on, that's part of it. But there's a whole other thing going on, Bob, which is that, one of the criticisms of magazines like ours, of the so-called journals of opinion, is that they preach to the choir. They preach to the converted.
Yeah.
And what I say about that, and it relates to your question about Bush, is, there is more space between our radical feminists and our libertarians. The radical feminists believe pornography should not be sold. Libertarians believe nothing should be banned. There is more space between the world federalists and top-down socialist planners and the Greens and the bioregionalists and the anarchists and the Luddites who read our magazine than there is between the Democratic and Republican parties. And it's a different kind of debate that you get inside of there. So it is true that the war in Iraq, the mass media's treatment of the war in Iraq, which was basically to internalize the values of the administration and to put their pronouncements on page one, and if there was any dissent from them, to treat dissent as disloyalty, that attitude was something that people across this country intuitively knew there was something wrong with. And those of them who were lucky enough to find The Nation found a home. And Carrie McWilliams once said, they found they were not alone. And we live in a society of opinion trusteeship, and they found a place where even though the writers disagree with each other about a lot of things, they could trust their basic set of values on a major issue like this. And Carrie McWilliams once said, when you find a reader like that, it's like a candle, giving him or her a candle in the dark, and you have a lifetime subscriber.
We're talking to Victor Novasky today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it earlier in the week, so please don't call in. Please just let us do the talking. Victor Novasky is the publisher of The Nation magazine. We've been talking about that, and we're talking about his brand new book, literally hot off the press, A Matter of Opinion, just published, which is a memoir and also an analysis of the history of The Nation and his role there. And it's a delightful read, and people interested in these issues, this is going to be must-read. I wish I had time to read the blurbs on the back, because this is a hall of fame of blurbing. People like Bill Moyers and John Kenneth Galbraith and Barbara Ehrenreich, Ken Auletta, basically saying this is the must-read book of 2005. And I think, you know, for people who are used to increasingly memoirs where you're going to get gossip and sort of stuff about someone's really mean person behind their back and, you know, that sort of dirty underwear stuff, this is not the book for you. This is not, but it's also a book that's very personal. I mean, you really get to know the people that Victor Navasky's writing about, including himself in the course of it. It's extraordinarily well written. So I urge you, my fair listeners, if this is your cup of tea, to pour yourself a large cup in the near future. Victor, The Nation magazine, you've alluded twice or three times now to Kerry McWilliams, who was the editor in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s. He was the editor of The Nation when I started reading it as a college student in the early 1970s. And instantly I was struck by The Nation. It grabbed me right away. I mean, I think he is a figure who, regrettably, I'm glad you're helping to resuscitate him, but whose reputation is really not kept up with his record. Can you talk a little bit about Kerry McWilliams?
Yeah. You know, one of the great fringe benefits for me was when I came to the magazine in 1978, Kerry had retired as of 1975, and Blair Clark was the interim editor. And I persuaded Kerry to come back and write a column every couple of weeks. And the fringe benefit was that in these days before the internet and email, he would jump on the subway at 112th Street where he lived and take it down to Greenwich Village and get off at West 4th Street, which was a block from where the Nation office was, and deliver his column, and then we'd go off and have lunch, and he'd have a couple of Rob Roys, which is was a drink that you don't hear about much anymore, and I would get a sense of the life of this extraordinary man. He had been a lawyer in California. He had worked with immigrants. He had written a number of extraordinary books on race in the United States. He coined the term, I believe, witch hunt. During the McCarthy years, wrote a book called Witch Hunt. He was one of the attorneys who worked on the briefs on the Hollywood Ten, and he had unlikely heroes for a man of the left. His heroes were people like Ambrose Bierce, about whom he wrote a book, H.L. Mencken, the great journalist, but not at all a left journalist, and Kerry parted his hair down the middle as a tribute to H.L. Mencken. And he came from Colorado, and he just was one of these people who had a feeling for what a weekly magazine of the Nation's sort could do, and he began contributing to it in the 30s. When he died, his widow, Iris, asked me to look over some of his papers. She was deciding where to give them, and I read a letter that he sent to H.L. Mencken when Mencken was editing the American Mercury. And he was a young man, and Mencken had sent him a note. He had read something that Kerry had written, and he said, if you have any ideas for the American Mercury, send me a note and let me know. And Kerry sent him a letter with something like 36 ideas. They're each of them expressed in a brief single-space paragraph on this kind of strange rectangular paper that's about half the size of a normal letterhead. And so there are these 36 ideas he sends out, and then I saw the letter back from Mencken. We'd like you to do all of them.
That's great. Well, you know, one of the things about Kerry McWilliams that struck me instantly and made me a Nation reader from 1972 on was that he had an ability to link the broad progressive left liberal communities in a way that, as you know as well as anyone, is very difficult to do. To sort of gain the respect of a broad constituency from really the middle of the Democratic Party out to people who would never be caught dead in the room with a Democrat.
Yes.
And that's always been a tension, as far as I can tell, at The Nation, that, you know, you've already talked about it, but the sort of the broad splits on many fundamental issues among not only your readers, but your staff members.
Yes. You know, I forget the exact year that Kerry died, but he had cancer. But before he died, when he was still very much functioning, turning in his column, although he was on chemotherapy and other things, he told me that he wanted to do a major piece on the radicals and the liberals. And that was, of course, the magazine that he ran. It expressed the tension between the radicals and the liberals, and carried on the debate between the radicals and liberals. And he thought that he might be able to do it with his son, Wilson Carey McWilliams, who is a political science professor at Rutgers, who just passed away himself. But they never, you know, Carey got too sick and he couldn't carry on with it. And but that was a lifelong interest of his. And I think, you know, those two tendencies, for me, are they are the emblem of the Nation magazine. And in the book, I quote the first sentence on the first page of the first issue, the first paragraph, the first article of the Nation in from July 6, 1865. And the first sentence is, which I consider one of the most courageous sentences in the history of American journalism, it is, "The week was singularly barren of exciting events." Now, you put that sentence alongside the famous sentence from William Lloyd Garrison's The Liberator, which was this abolitionist magazine whose subscription list, it went out of business when the Civil War ended, and the Nation inherited their subscription list. And Garrison's line was, "I will not equivocate, I will not excuse, I will not retreat a single inch." And I took those two sentences to be sort of the war between, or the difference between the radicals and the liberals. The liberal part of the first sentence was, we're not going to play this false, hype, trendy buzz thing that people like Tina Brown or Graydon Carter do these days when they launch a new magazine. We're going to tell you the truth. And if the truth is that nothing much of interest happened this week, well, that's what we're going to tell you. And you can count on us to be very straight about it. The Garrison line, "I will not equivocate, I will not excuse, I will not," is a radical's impassioned statement of belief in the cause of abolition. And it's the great fight. And it's the ability to have this conversation between those two sensibilities that, at its best, I think, carries on the tradition of the Carey McWilliams Nation.
We're talking to Victor Novasky today on Media Matters. Again, this show is recorded earlier in the week, so please don't try to call in. Just sit back and enjoy the show. Carey McWilliams is the former editor and current publisher of The Nation magazine. We've been talking about The Nation and its history, and the author of a terrific new book, A Matter of Opinion, just published, came out this week, available, I'm certain, in fine bookstores everywhere, and I urge you to take a look at it if this is something that interests you. One of the issues, too, related that you talk about in the book, and I think that comes up during your reign as editor, and certainly is an issue since you've been followed by Katrina VandenHeuvel, who, by the way, has been a frequent guest on this program, is the relationship to politicians and the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And you know, it's the tension you talk about between the radicals and liberals often manifests itself near an election. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah. You know, when I was back when I was putting out a little satire magazine called Monocle at the Yale Law School, one day someone knocked on my door, and he was a student from the Harvard Law School, and he was very interested in satire as a form of social criticism, and he introduced himself, and his name was Ralph Nader. And he was working on a paper about unsafe automobiles at the time, and it turned out he published that as an article in the Nation magazine. Now, when Ralph, and he's been a contributor to the magazine over the years and a longtime friend, but when Ralph announced for the presidency last time, not this time around, the first time, there was a big split on the magazine staff between those who believe that it's always wrong to get involved in so-called lesser evilism and vote for the lesser evil between the two major party candidates, and others who, and why not vote for someone who you agree with? And there was 100% agreement with the Nader platform, which identified the problems with globalization and all of the other things that the great consumer advocate who helped invent the public interest movement stands for. And yet, on the one hand, on the other hand, there was a real disinclination on the part of more than half the staff to risk a Bush presidency. And so in the first go-around, that tension expressed itself in an editorial which basically said, vote to beat Bush no matter how you have to do it, and vote your conscience where you can. code word for vote for Nader, which I happen to have voted for Nader, but I come from New York State, and there, it was no contest in New York State. The second time around, it was we were going into a war in Iraq, and it really seemed an imperative not to let these guys come back. And the nation ran an open letter urging Ralph not to run. But ever since I've been there, in starting in 78, this argument comes up every 4 years. And if you go back to and read old editorials, say in 1948, when Henry Wallace ran against Harry Truman, Tom Dewey, and the Dixiecrats put up a candidate of their own, Strom Thurmond, the magazine that year, very interestingly, did not take a position on the presidency. They were very forthright in analyzing the issues and the problems with the Truman platform, but they couldn't bring themselves to support a third-party candidate that year. So it's a perpetual dilemma and argument, and if you would ask people to sign a thing on who do you most agree with, Dennis Kucinich, who came through the office, would have won on that ballot, but he didn't win on who you're going to vote for ballot.
We're talking to Victor Novasky today here on Media Matters. Once again, this is a pre-recorded show. Don't call in. 1 week from today, on May 22nd, our guest will be the actor and filmmaker Tim Robbins. And 2 weeks from today, our guest will be the investigative journalist Greg Palast. So please be back with live shows in the next 2 weeks. I hope you will be able to join us then. Victor Novasky, what about John Kerry? What sort of discussions went on in the Nation office around him as the Democratic standard bearer? What was the assessment of his campaign?
Well, I think they're reflected in the magazine, and people were hopeful at the beginning, very disappointed in the campaign that he ran. You hear about his vote on the war and all of that, and it seemed to me that, let me just talk about my own view about this for a second, and the magazine shared it, I think, to an extent, but we had a number of different people who weighed in, but it seemed to me that the parties were split, or the American people were split about 45-45 going into the election. And there were 45% who were for Bush no matter what, and 45% who were against Bush no matter what. And the 10% that were up for grabs, it seemed to me, were not going to make their decision on a left-right basis. Those folks had already made up their mind. Maybe one or two might, but basically that 10% was up for grabs, and they were going to make their decision based partly on the debates, but really on who they connected with, who they trusted. And it seemed to me that Kerry, who started from this with this very stirring and brave and articulate act as a young Vietnam War veteran, had a base on which to build. And whether a majority of people in this country were for or against the war in Iraq, I think that they were looking for someone who they could trust and who was authentic. And to the extent that Kerry didn't talk about the war after the convention, he just stopped. He chimed in with Howard Dean at the beginning. He was defensive on the Swift boat stuff, but he didn't. There wasn't this integrated person out there. You felt he was playing a little bit of the Al Gore game of having his finger to the wind, and I think that hurt him in a deep way, and I think the magazine felt that in the same way. And so looking back, it seems to me if he had basically articulated his version of the Howard Dean, Jonathan Schell, Katrina Vandenheuvel, Nation magazine view about the problems with going into Iraq the way we did on our own, without going to the UN, without letting the inspectors finish their job, and thinking that you can impose democracy, which to me is an oxymoron. If he had come out with his version of why that was an unrealistic policy and stuck with it, and I think we might have a different president.
You know, one thing you talk about early in your book is how in the 1990s, when you were leaving the role as editor during the Clinton administration, there were significant debates among nation staffers and writers, and certainly among readers, about U.S. interventions around the world in the Balkans and Africa, Haiti, Kosovo especially. And this wasn't the case with the invasion and occupation of Iraq, where there was virtual unanimity from the get-go, with one notable exception, Christopher Hitchens, who was a columnist for The Nation for, I think, for decades, 15, 20 years, if I'm not mistaken. And I think by all accounts, one of the great writers that The Nation's ever published, but who increasingly became a devotee of U.S. invasions as a way to solve problems in the world. And intolerant of people who did not share that perspective. I don't know if I'm fair for characterizing his perspective accurately, but that's my sense of it from reading him. And he did something interesting, I thought, which was he more or less fired the readers, if they, I think of sort of a Brechtian term. Because he left The Nation, but he wasn't forced out, was he?
Oh, to the contrary, we ran an editorial on the occasion of his resignation, where he resigned in the last paragraph of his biweekly column, which was news to us that when we received the column that he wasn't going to do another one. We urged him both privately and then publicly in the magazine to stick around. And his column was called Minority Report, and the Christopher that we had been in touch with before that, as I said in Matter of Opinion, would have stuck around and had the argument. And I think it would have been useful to all of us if he had done so, including him. And, you know, he said things after he left about the left and The Nation, things about people on the left believing that John Ashcroft was a greater threat than Osama bin Laden. Well, no one in the Nation office believed that, and that caused some resentment on the one hand. On the other hand, in the greater scheme of things, there's a lot of affection for him in the office, as wrong-headed as we believe his views on the current situation are. And we still have hopes that he's going to see the light. He was good enough to show up at a reading that I did the other night. So it's very complicated.
Yeah, here's a question. This doesn't necessarily involve Christopher Hitchens, but it's an interesting question. What if, well, let's use Hitchens since he's an example. Let's say he supported George W. Bush and just went all the way over and became a full-blown neoconservative with the domestic agenda, the economic policies, the works, and then said, I want to write for you again.
Right.
Would the door be open?
Well, you know, that's one of those counterfactuals that I don't I can't accept, because I can't see him doing that. I can with his kind of Luddite value system and his problems with not only evangelical Christianity but any kind of belief in God. It comes in it from a different place.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, during the campaign, I'll tell you, this is not in the book because it happened after the book. I don't know whether I would have put it in anyway. But during the campaign, we were sitting around having an editorial discussion one day, and one of the editors, it was Karen Rothmeyer, a very good, talented editor, I think we're doing our readers a disservice, she said, because they can't understand why anyone in his or her right mind would vote for George Bush. And yet, clearly, half the people in this country are for George Bush, at least. And we ought to find a way of explaining that to them. So out of this discussion, we said, well, okay, well, who could do that? Who do they say? Well, let's ask Christopher. So there was a sort of, around the table, there was a sort of unanimous thought. We should ask Christopher to do this. And I was deputized to make the call. And I called him, and Christopher, at first, there was silence at the other end when I put this to him. We hadn't talked in a long time. And then he said, well, you know, I've never said that before, that I'm for him, and I guess I ought to face the implications of all of the positions I've been taking, and I'm glad you asked. Yes, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
So then I reported back yesterday, and then people began to have second thoughts. Hey, do we really want to waste a extremely valuable piece of real estate, a page in the magazine, at this critical moment in the country's history on the case for George Bush. And ultimately, we decided to go forward with the original plan. And Christopher wrote something, which didn't cause that much of a stir, and as it happened. So I don't know whether that's fully responsive to your question, but, you know, there was a disposition to do it, and then a second thought, even before he's made that trajectory that you project.
Mm-hmm. Well, and on the other side of the coin, other nation columnists over the past few years, I'm thinking specifically of Alex Coburn and Katha Pollitt, have periodically chimed in with their publicly with their disagreements with editorial policy at the Nation.
Oh, not only that, but Alex, on a regular basis, as I do recount in the book, has attacked virtually every one of the best left liberal writers and thinkers in the country who has anything to do with the magazine. So he keeps declaring his independence.
We're talking to Victor Nevasky today, the publisher of The Nation magazine and previously the longtime editor and a journalist of some standing for a good 4+ decades. He's also the author of the brand new book, A Matter of Opinion, just published this week. I urge you to take a look at it. You're listening to Media Matters. This show we pre-recorded a few days before we went on air, so please do not try to call in today. Just sit back and let us do the talking. We'll be back 1 week from today live with the actor and filmmaker Tim Robbins. Victor, to me, the most interesting stuff in the book, personally, because of my intellectual interest and from my former professional experience as a magazine publisher, comes with your talking about the economics of publishing, the journalist opinion. That's a lot of this book. I mean, there's a lot in here about you're trying to make this be a solvent enterprise when you're sort of like a Geary on the Amazon, you know, trying to somehow, in a hopeless situation, trying to keep this ship afloat. I mean, talk a little bit broadly about the problems something like The Nation, a publication like The Nation, faces as a viable business enterprise, and then sort of the dilemma you faced or the options you faced as you tried to address that when you took over the publishing.
Yes. Well, you know, I'm going to go back to Carrie McWilliams a little bit. Before I came in as editor of The Nation, I was talking to Carrie. We had lunch one day, and Ham Fish, who was just out of Harvard, whom I had met during the Ramsey Clark campaign for the United States Senate. I was what I call his campaign mismanager, and Ham was in charge of our fundraising operation. He was in his early 20s, and he was really looking for a publisher. He wasn't aiming to do it himself. In the end, he ended up with doing it himself. And I was asking Carrie what he thought about all that, and Carrie said that The Nation had never had someone who a really bright person who was dedicated to making it work as a business, who didn't have business values, but nevertheless had the kind of entrepreneurial energy and to carry forward and do it. And Carrie would send these memos to the staff that he called night thoughts on how to make the thing work as a business. You should have luncheons all over the country with speakers like Martin Luther King, who is filing annual civil rights reports, and charge people for the price of admission, a new subscription, and all kinds of creative notions like that. And so I came to this thing with Ham thinking that we wanted to do something on that front. People don't, you know, the people who want to work for these magazines are people who have editorial passions and ideas. It's not people from the business side. And Carrie thought that we probably could recruit someone from the trade union movement. But we never found the magic business person, and Ham went off to run for office. He's now back and running the Nation Institute. So when I when the publisher of The Nation, Arthur Carter, made me an offer I should have refused, Bob, and sold me the magazine for $1 million that I did not have. And it was a magazine that was losing money at the rate of $500,000 a year. I had to go out and raise lots of money. And the $1 million was not down. He sold to me for nothing down, but payable $100,000 a year for 10 years at 6% interest, which my lawyer, my brother-in-law, told me it was cheap money. And I said to him, well, how am I explain to my wife, your sister, that it's cheap money to go and take responsibility for a magazine that's losing $500,000 a year, which we don't have for this year or any other year? But nevertheless, so what I did was I went to a friend who was on the faculty of the Harvard Business School and tried to persuade him to take us as a case study, giving them the problem, as MBA students the problem. How do you take a magazine that's been losing $500,000 a year for 125 years by that time, and without changing the magazine, turn around its economics? And he basically said, well, it's a great idea for a case study, but, you know, but not for the MBA students. We have a program for owners and presidents and CEOs of small businesses, and these people don't have the IQs of the MBA students, but they have experience, and they're much cockier, and they come for 3 weeks a year for 3 years, and we could make it a case study for them, and you'd have 100 free consultants to help you. But you know something? You ought to take this course because you don't know what you're doing. And he was absolutely right. I'm not a business person. And I said, I ought to maybe, but I can't do that. I've taken a sabbatical to begin work on my book and this and the other thing. And then I thought about it and said, well, if I'm going to take the job of a publisher seriously, I ought to do it. And I found a way to do it, and I did end up taking that course. And I learned some things. I didn't learn that much, but the one thing that I did when we got out of there was I rounded up some major shareholders and raised about half the capital that we thought we needed from them. And then we got a formula where we decided that we would raise the other half of the capital we thought we needed from a circle of 100 really subscribers, small shareholders, people who were part of our community already, and we were trying to raise $5,000 from each of them, $5,000 a year, until we reached a point where we were paying our own way in the world. And we were able to do that because there is such loyalty to this magazine, and the loyalty came from it having been there for 125 years before we got there. And when I got out of the Harvard thing, and when I became publisher, a former Nation intern did a radio interview with me, and they asked me, "How can you possibly expect this magazine to pay for itself when it's lost these, you know, hundreds, millions of dollars over the last 125, 130 years?" And I said, "Well," and I made a joke. I said, "Well, you know, I consider that an investment in the past, and we're going to capitalize on that past investment. They invested in the brand name. They invested in it." Well, it was a joke, but it turned out to be sort of true. And one of the peculiar things that happened was last year we got something like 28,000 subscribers who came to us over our free website, and they are paying subscribers to the hard copy magazine. And when Ham Fish and I got here in 1978, we had only 20,000 total. And when I did my projections of what kinds of capital we would need and what our revenue would be and what our costs would be when I became publisher, there was no provision in there for anything to do with the Internet, because it really wasn't up and running yet in any way that we understood. So that's one of the ways that an independent journal like The Nation maybe can survive, and not just us. I mean, we have the advantage of having been around 125 years before that, but that is a subsidiary right, and it helps us to make ends meet.
Victor Navasky, in your book, A Matter of Opinion, you talk about the option that faced you as a publisher to follow the path that almost all other liberal and left journals of opinion followed, which was to become officially a nonprofit institution. So people would lend you money or give you money and write it off in their taxes. They wouldn't be owners. And also you would get a much lower mailing rate. And for a publication like The Nation, which sends out almost all its circulation through the mails, that's an enormous savings. Yet you decided not to go that route. How come?
Yes, well, in the United States, if you are a nonprofit, you're not allowed to endorse candidates for office, number one. You're not allowed to devote more than a very small percentage of your resources to try to influence legislation, number two. We wanted to be able to do both of those things. But number three, I had seen, when I was researching, I did a book on the Justice Department under Robert Kennedy, and I had seen the Justice Department team up with the IRS to put nonprofits out of business when they thought they were breaking the law or violating the Constitution. And it happened. I agreed with them at the time. These were segregationist organizations that were violating the Constitution. But I saw the power of the government to do this against minority organizations. And then when the Reagan administration came to power, they tried to take away Mother Jones's tax status, and Mother Jones spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and years defending themselves. And the administration failed, but had they succeeded, they would not just have taken away their nonprofit status, which meant they couldn't save their $250,000 a year or whatever they were saving by having it, but they would have gone after them for every past year when they had that status.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then they would have added penalty payments and interest payments. And when you do that, you put them out of business.
That's,
and I didn't want to be the one who's responsible for the nation being put out of business. So.
Yeah, that's certainly understandable. Now, there's also something called the Nation Institute, which you write about, which, now, correct me if I'm wrong, that is a nonprofit group.
That is a nonprofit. And we have a lawyer who treats them like church and state. They're not allowed to pay editor salaries. They're not allowed to pay for direct mail, subscription mailings. They're not allowed to pay the printer. They are allowed to run conferences, and they are allowed to run a teaching intern program. Like, we teach our interns how to fact check, and it would be cheaper for they pay the interns $150 a week to do this. Now, originally, they paid them nothing. It would be cheaper for us to just hire a couple of fact checkers as full-time staff people than every 3 months to have our editors spend very important time training new young people on how to do this. So it's a fair trade-off, but the great thing for the magazine of having the Institute next door is a constant flood of young people comes through, and some of these interns end up at the magazine, the most notable one being Katrina Vandenheuvel, who started as an intern, and others. So it's an invaluable ally to have, but it can't cross the line and solve our financial problems for us.
We're talking to Victor Navasky today on Media Matters. We've only got about 5 or 6 minutes left. Victor Navasky is the publisher of The Nation. We've been talking a lot about The Nation during this show. Of course, our listeners know that we have had many Nation writers on the program, most notably John Nichols, who's virtually a co-host. He's on so often. Katrina Vandenheuvel, Alex Coburn, Eric Alterman. The list goes on and on. Victor Navasky's new book, A Matter of Opinion, chronicles his career in journalism going back to his college days through to his editing The Nation and being the publisher. It's just released. It's a delightful read. I urge you all to take a close look at it. Victor, stand back for a second, if you would. And you've been involved in liberal, progressive, left politics. I mean, in The Nation, with its special charter, really linking these broad branches of left to center politics. Where do you think liberal, left, progressive politics stand today compared to 20 or 30 years ago? And do you have a sense of a trajectory as you look at what you've experienced?
Well, I'll start further back than that, because with the McCarthy years, I think that the whole progressive community was on the skids during the McCarthy period. They were on the run, and in some cases in flight from themselves. The trade union movement was injured by the Red Hunt that went on. Magazines like The Nation were marginalized even more than they are in the day-to-day world in which they operated. The Cold War speak took over the national vocabulary, and then it wasn't until the New Left kind of came along, and the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, the left began to build up again. And to the extent that the Democratic Party caught on to that, understood that, and reflected that, it intermittently came back into power. Right now, I don't think there is a thing called the left. I think there are a lot of tendencies out there on the left. I think the movement that you're involved in, the anti-big media movement, is a very significant development on the political landscape. I think it's premature to see where all of this is going to lead, but I think one of the best hopes for having it lead anywhere is to deal with a problem which had not been seen as a problem back then and is increasingly seen as such today. So I think there have to be a lot of breakthroughs all across many different areas for there to something to come clearly into sight.
You know, the reason, one of the reasons I ask that is in the book you talk about a number of the publications that tried to emulate the Nation or follow in the Nation's path and become liberal or progressive or radical journals of opinion in the 1970s, sort of on the heels of this burst of the new left. Politics, 7 Days, names I think that very few listeners will remember. And the most notable, In These Times, which still is alive and kicking up in Chicago, founded by James Weinstein. You know, James Weinstein, in his first, I think, editorial, when he announced the publication of In These Times in November 1976, as you talk about in the book, said basically, we're going to go as far as the left goes. The left doesn't take off, we're going to be struggling and really have a hard time staying alive. If the left takes off, we're going to prosper like Appeal to Reason did, the great socialist newspaper from the turn of the century. And then I think following that, it's pretty obvious. Well, look at In These Times today. The left is not taken off. And it's, if anything, I think Weinstein would say it's retrenched in those 30 years. I mean, do you, I mean, I don't mean to pin you down here, but you have a perspective not many of my guests ever have with the wealth of experience you've had. What are the hopeful signs in the horizon? Because I get asked this all the time by younger callers.
Well,
and my students.
I think it's it may be it's the wrong question, Bob, that it's not left-right only, that it's, as Hightower, Jim Hightower keeps saying, it's top-bottom. And it is green, and that's the difference between the Greens and the old-fashioned socialist planners, but there is a common core of values there. So I think there's a lot of ferment going on and a lot of interesting opportunity for conversation going on that... both within the left community, but between the left community and a new generation of young people who are, I think, have the ethic of social service. It's not a political ethic so much as a humankind ethic. And that's not a terrible thing. You want to politicize that to make them effective in the world political community, and yet you don't want to dilute it, because they're there to deal with problems ranging from homelessness to AIDS to poverty to hurricanes, and I think that's a hopeful sign.
Now, you teach at Columbia in the journalism school.
Yeah.
And you teach every semester or once a year? Or?
Well, it's complicated, but I'm basically at the school. I took off the fall semester the last 3 or 4 years in order to work on my book, but in theory I'm there.
How long have you been teaching there?
I think seven years.
Have you noticed a change in those 7 years? It's an awfully short time span in the sort of students you're getting in your classes.
The students at the journalism school invest $50,000 in their education, and they want to get their money back, their money's worth, and they're very job-oriented. I did have a student came to me a couple of years ago. He was from Pakistan. He said that he was concerned that they were getting a corporate education here, corporate journalism, and not in the kind of journalism that the Nation represents, and what could they do about it. And so we had a meeting. He brought together about 25 of his fellow students, and I said to him, look, you're at a great research university. You have people teaching here like Eric Foner, like Edward Said, who was still around then, Patricia Williams, Manning Marable, who runs the African American Studies program here. So why don't you call them and meet with them on a regular basis, and don't rely on the J School, which is a craft school primarily. I mean, I do teach. I did start an opinion writing course here, and I run a magazine workshop. But and don't let yourself be defined by the institution. Use the larger institution, the resources at it, to find your own way. And they did, and they had success in inviting them in. So it was a good thing.
Victor Navasky, the band is tuning up in the background, so it's time for me to check out.
Okay.
I'm going to thank you so much for joining
thank
us today, Victor.
Much,
Victor Navasky, the publisher of The Nation, the author of the brand new book, A Matter of Opinion. I urge you all to read it. My
name
is Bob McChesney. I'll be back 1 week from today with Tim Robbins. Have a good week.
We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy and breezy with a high in the upper 50s and northwest winds 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts to 30 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy in the evening, then clearing, the low in the upper 30s with northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour this evening, becoming light and variable. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. A Prairie Home Companion will not be heard this afternoon, so we can bring you a live broadcast of the University of Illinois commencement ceremonies with keynote speaker Bill Geist. We now go over to the Assembly Hall with your host, Jay Pierce. It's 2 p.m.